This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. Neil Conan is on vacation. This past Saturday, the front page of the New York Times carried a photo of a young boy sitting on a street in Monrovia, the capital of the war-torn West African country, Liberia. The boy's mouth is open. He's staring straight into the camera and pointing a rifle directly at it. On his back, the boy is carrying a pack. It's pink and fuzzy and looks like a stuffed animal. While many of the images we see of child soldiers are in African countries, the problem is a global one. The UN says there are about 300,000 child soldiers fighting in conflicts around the world and in both government and insurgent forces. And while the use of children as soldiers is probably as old as war itself, today's child soldier is usually forced into combat, often abducted, sometimes drugged by the armies who want to use them for fighting. Young girl soldiers are often forced into prostitution as well. This hour, we'll talk about the life of the child soldier, what's being done to prevent children from being abducted into combat, and what programs are available after they've left fighting to help them reintegrate into their families and communities. We'd like to hear from you. Have you traveled or worked in war-torn countries that have child soldiers? Tell us what you saw. What do you think the U.S. and the international community can do to help? Are you from a country where child soldiers are used? Call us with your experiences. The number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is TOTN@npr.org. Joining us from Freetown in Sierra Leone is Frances Fortune. She's the West Africa director for the nonprofit organization Search for Common Ground. Her group runs a radio program called The Golden Kids News to help former child soldiers once they are demobilized. Thanks for joining us, Frances.
Hi, Lynn. How are you?
Good. Frances, can you tell us something about the young people you work with in your program who have been child soldiers?
Yes. Well, most of them are under 14. That's the age that we've been looking for, between 7 and 14. Most of them, of course, have been out of school for a number of years, disturbed. Their schooling was, of course, disturbed by the war and had been abducted for the most part. And coming out of war, we got connected with them through the care system that was established to look after these young kids whilst the tracing of their families went on. So this is how we got linked up with these kids. And we trained them up as cub reporters, and they were really keen.
How difficult is it for these young kids to re-enter society? Are they, and to connect up with their families again?
Well, I think there's no simple answer to that. Your families are always happy to have their children back, I have to say, number one. However, you know, this is a country that's been through 10 years of war, and everybody's struggling with poverty conditions, and having another mouth to feed is often very difficult. And often the child who left or who was abducted because you as a family often couldn't protect them is not the child who comes back. And, you know, that's often very difficult. But on the whole, I think that the society has been very accepting of young kids coming back into the midst of schools and, you know, the other kinds of things that are available for them. I think generally the society has been very accepting because realizing that these kids are actually victims, you know.
You said that this is not the child who left. Are these children more adults now when they come back, or are they still children?
Physically, they might be children, but mentally, they're not children any longer. And they're very mature, usually having had the kind of exposure. I mean, some of these kids walked the length and the breadth of this country with various fighting factions and have seen things that you and I never hoped to see in our lives, you know, and have had to deal with it in their own way. So they're very mature, very exposed, and as a matter of fact, they make great reporters because they're not afraid to ask any kind of question.
Now, you work with these kids in radio. Why do you think that's a particularly, and as journalists, why is that a particularly, perhaps a good thing to educate them in as they're returning into society from these terrible situations they've been in?
Well, when we started this program a couple of years ago, you know, this was the time that kids were just starting to be disarmed and demobilized. And we thought it was important that communities where these kids came from and the society generally get ready for these kids coming back. It wasn't going to be just an automatic, you know, slot back into your family. And so we thought that this was a good way to do some advocacy work. Who better to do the advocacy work than them? And it was, you know, it helped to sort of raise the self-esteem of these kids pretty much across the board, because if you heard one ex-soldier telling his story on this program, for instance, you know, all the other ones could relate to it. And there's very much that feeling about it in its initial days. We have broadened out in terms of the cub reporters that we have now. It's not just child soldiers, because we're trying to get rid of the labeling. So we've tried to bring in other kids also underprivileged, you know. But we thought it was a very good advocacy tool that they could use to actually help prepare the community and themselves for reintegration.
Does this work for all the kids, or are some of them so traumatized that they really can't stand up and do what the kids in your program do?
Yes, certainly. Certainly, there's a lot of kids who are unable and, you know, certainly who are not able to express themselves adequately. It's not every kid who can do this, that's for sure.
One other thing, you work with both boys and girls, correct?
That's right.
And is this more difficult for girls, or are girls treated differently? What are the problems specific to the girls who have been abducted and forced to be soldiers?
Well, the girls, a lot of them came back with babies, for instance, so they have responsibility, which, you know, at the age of 14 or 15, who wants to have a baby at that age? You know, it's, and also trying to deal with coming back into your family. Are they going to accept you and your baby? I mean, they don't have skills in which to find a livelihood. Can they go to school again? How are they going to take care of this child? Is their family going to help them? Their problems are compounded a thousandfold compared to a young man or a young boy who is on his own. Having that responsibility of a child is quite crippling for these young girls, I would say.
And Frances, what other kinds of programs, if any, are available for these kids other than the one that you're running?
Well, actually, UNICEF has set up a whole care system for the child soldiers who are coming out of war, and various things were available through them through different NGOs. They had some skills training centers. They tried to get them slotted back into schools. And those kinds of things. But in terms of dealing with a child trauma, let me say, or counseling, there wasn't very much of that kind of thing that was available. It was very much about getting them back into their families as fast as they can and hopefully learning how to cope within the family.
Would you say that more is needed there?
Well, certainly. I think that definitely in Sierra Leone, there's more that needs to be done with children. I would say in Liberia as well, where a whole thousands of kids are being remobilized into the war that's going on there now. We need to work harder at this, particularly for the girl children. You know, the focus is really very much on the boys because I think it's easier. But the girls who are abducted and used as sex slaves or domestic slaves, you know, we really need to find ways and means to help these young girls get back in and be productive members of society.
All right. Well, thank you so much for speaking with us, Frances.
Okay, Lynn. Thank you.
Frances Fortune is the West Africa Director at Search for Common Ground. She spoke to us from Freetown, Sierra Leone. And joining us now from our bureau in New York is Jo Becker. She's the Child Rights Advocacy Director for Human Rights Watch. Thanks for being with us, Jo.
Sure, no problem.
Jo, we've been talking about the situation in Sierra Leone, but the problem goes well beyond Africa. Give us a sense of how widespread the use of children as soldiers is.
It's really a global problem. I think many people associate it with Africa because those are the images that they most often see through the media. But in fact, children are used as soldiers in just about every region of the world. Many people are surprised, for example, to find out that the country with the largest number of child soldiers in the world is in Asia. It's Burma, where about 70,000 boys are currently serving with the National Army there. Other countries include the Philippines, Sri Lanka, Colombia, Afghanistan, and a number of others.
Now, kids have always been used in wars to some degree, isn't that right?
Yes, it's true, but we haven't seen children used in the numbers that we have in the last few decades. There's been a real trend towards increasing use of children in conflict situations. And there are a couple of reasons for that. One is the evolution of weapons technology. Weapons have become lighter and easier to use, especially semi-automatics, so that even a child of 10, you know, can wield an AK-47 or an M16. Another factor is the changing nature of armed conflicts. 100 years ago, conflicts were most likely to be between states and fought by, you know, regular armed forces in a very well-defined battleground. But today, conflicts are much more likely to be within countries, inter-ethnic conflicts, where any neighborhood can become a battle zone. Civilians have become the primary victims of armed conflict. And in these situations, children are much more easily caught up as both victims and as perpetrators.
And it's both governments and also insurgent forces who are using children, correct?
That's correct. Insurgent forces or opposition armies sometimes get more attention because, on the whole, they tend to recruit children at younger ages and are often responsible for greater atrocities. But that's not always the case, and there are certainly many governments around the world that are using children also.
We're talking about the use of children as soldiers. If you'd like to join our discussion, the number is 800-989-8255. Adam in Columbus, Ohio. Hi, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hi.
Go ahead.
My name is Adam O'Hershey. I live in Columbus, and I'm originally from Somalia.
Mm-hmm.
In Somalia, there are warlords who use the children as soldiers. And the standard they use for that is if the child can reach a camel, if he can milk a she-camel, he can fight. They don't see the age, but they see the appearance of a child, and they make them fight.
We've seen other similar practices in other countries. For example, they line children up, and if the child is as tall as the length of a gun, they'll be recruited.
That's exactly what they do. The other mean is that they use children is that they make them spies, send mm-hmm. them to the strongholds of the other warlords so that they can lay back information from the place that they just visited. And the other guys used to kill the children that is suspected of being spies.
Yes. Sometimes children are used for the most dangerous tasks, as spies, for example, or they're pushed into battle zones ahead of older troops to detonate landmines, for example. Sometimes they're pushed into suicide missions because they're not as valued as older troops. Or sometimes they're used because they're not going to be as easily detectable. For example, a child gathering information may not be as obvious as an adult soldier trying to gather intelligence.
Thanks for your call, Adam. Also, I've read, I think, that children sometimes do commit atrocities, or some of the worst atrocities sometimes.
They do. One of the reasons why children are recruited is because they're vulnerable and they are often gullible. Children who are recruited at young ages often don't have a well-defined sense of what's right and what's wrong. And they may be more willing to follow orders without question than older soldiers. And so commanders will take advantage of this, and they will send children into battle and to commit atrocities.
We're going to continue our discussion about child soldiers when we come back. If you'd like to send us an email, the address is totn@npr.org. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. We're talking about the use of children as soldiers and what's being done to stop the practice. Our guest is Joe Becker, Child Rights Advocacy Director for Human Rights Watch. Join the discussion. Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Joe, would you say, or is it accepted at all, that there's any context in which it's ethically justified to use children as soldiers?
We would say no. International human rights norms say that a child is anyone under the age of 18, and that a child is entitled to certain protections. They shouldn't be used for abusive child labor, they shouldn't be tortured, as any human shouldn't, and they shouldn't be exploited in armed conflict situations. Children need time to mature, and using them as soldiers in some of the most dangerous environments in the world is, you know, certainly not acceptable.
Is there a tendency for kids who have grown up as soldiers, grown up in these situations, to be more violent when they reenter society?
Well, part of the problem is that children who have been recruited as soldiers are automatically taken out of a family environment. They're often denied access to education. And so for many of them, even if they want to leave soldiering behind, they may not have any other viable options in terms of jobs. They may not even be able to read. And so for many, once they've been recruited as a soldier, it means they'll always be a soldier.
And what about the young girls who are literally forced into prostitution as well as soldiering?
Children, well, girls in a number of countries are used not only to fight, but are also sexually exploited. In northern Uganda, for example, girls are forced to become wives to older commanders. Many of them become pregnant. They're forced to give birth, you know, without medical assistance. Many of them contract sexually transmitted diseases and end up with children besides themselves that they're responsible to care for. In Colombia, there are large numbers of girls that are used by both guerrilla and paramilitary forces, and their sexual exploitation is also common, but the forces don't want to be bothered by pregnancy and childbirth, and so they force the girls to use contraception. They give them contraceptive injections, they implant contraceptives or IUDs.
And I've also read that kids are sometimes drugged by their captors in order to get them to fight, I guess, or to just keep them compliant. What about the use of drugs?
It's both. Many children already have a lower level of fear in armed conflict situations because they don't really understand what it's about. But even so, some commanders will give them alcohol or drugs to lower resistance further or to sort of get them geared up to fight. Children in Colombia, for example, described drinking milk that had been mixed with gunpowder as a way of taking away fear. Other children, for example, in Burma have been given amphetamines as a way to, you know, drive them into battle.
We're talking about the use of children as soldiers in conflicts around the world. The number is 800-989-8255 if you'd like to join the discussion. We're going to go now to Bernard in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Hello, Bernard.
Yes, hello.
Hi, go ahead.
Yes, well, I was 10, 11 years old when the conflict in Congo started for independence. The local black guys wanted to kick the white guys out, so they killed a few, quite a few. They ate a few, they put them a few to pieces. And we got arrested, like, you know, a lot of other white guys, and guarded by kids. Now, the kids who were there were under the influence of pombe, which is a very heavy alcohol. The mothers were there behind and laughing when they killed white guys. You know, they would take one out of the rank of we were and then cut his head off or cut some other part of his body off and play with it. And the kids would find it very amusing. Now, we did not, as a kid, because I was 11 years old, we did not always realize, you know, the atrocity of the whole thing. We realized how bad it was, etc. We were frightened like hell. But that was as far as it went because we were kids also. So I can, in some way, relate with the way they were reacting.
Because you yourself, you're saying, as you were so young that even you couldn't quite comprehend?
That's correct. We knew it was bad. I mean, of course, and because it was our friends who were decapitated or killed in bad manners in front of us with machetes and, you know, that kind of thing. And having a 6-year-old kid with machine guns and laughing his head off because he's cut somebody in pieces with bullets is something we understand was really bad. But we didn't understand it as bad as our parents did. You understand what I'm saying?
Yes, I do. And Joe Becker, I'm just wondering if you can respond to this pretty horrifying account that we're hearing?
Yeah. I think one of the factors that's at play here is the youth of the children, that they really don't understand, you know, what this is about and what the consequences are to their victims. In many cases, we've also seen that children are forced to commit these kinds of atrocities or be killed themselves. In Uganda, in Colombia, in the Democratic Republic of Congo, in Burma, a number of places, children have described that they have to do these things if they want to survive.
Well, I don't think at the time, I'm sorry to interrupt you, I don't think at the time they had to. At the time, mm-hmm. they were just drugged, and as I say, the mothers were there behind them, and they were all drinking alcohol, 6 years old kid drinking an alcohol that if you have one glass, you're totally drunk. And I'm talking heavy people. So you realize a kid of 6, 7, 8 years old, it has some very bad influence on them.
Yeah, agreed.
And it's, you know, kids don't realize what's happening and what they're doing. They're just having fun.
Yeah. Thanks so much for your call, Bernard.
Pleasure. Thank you.
That's a really terrifying perspective that I think we just heard. Let's go now to Elaine Chao. Last month, the Labor Department announced that the United States would give $13 million to help rehabilitate child soldiers worldwide. And joining us now to discuss the program is the Secretary of Labor, Elaine Chao. Welcome, Madam Secretary, to the program.
Thank you.
First of all, why is the Department of Labor, the United States Department of Labor, getting involved in this issue?
Yes, I don't think very many people realize that we are involved, and we're very much concerned about what's happening, because the plight of children involved in armed conflict is not only a human rights issue, but it's a labor issue. And the forced recruitment of children for use in armed conflict is identified in the International Labor Organization's convention as one of the worst forms of child labor. So the United States is one of the first countries to ratify convention. It's called Convention Number 182, and we believe strongly that all these forms of child labor should be eliminated as a matter of urgency.
Now, how will the $13 million be used? What's that going for, that money?
Well, $13 million is just this one time. We've given hundreds in the past. But the $13 million that I announced in May was to help fight, prevent, and rehabilitate child soldiers. There's a $7 million global project through the International Labor Organization International Program on Elimination of Child Labor. And then there's also $3 million that will go to the educational needs of former child soldiers in northern Uganda, and another $13 million that will go to focus on the educational needs of former child soldiers in Afghanistan.
What kinds of rehabilitation and educational programs are out there?
We are learning a lot about how to prevent child labor and child soldiering, and also what's needed for them to be fully reintegrated into the communities from whence they came. And I think what we're learning is that we need a comprehensive and a strategic approach, and that means demobilization and disarmament. It means family reunification. It means education, job training, psychosocial support, and then also helping the entire community to prepare for these children's returns. So the problem of child soldiers really requires a comprehensive and integrated approach. And local strategies can include everything, you know, from providing birth certificates, for example, to children to help them prove their age, or to special protection facilities for girls, to building or rebuilding schools and training teachers. So the conference that we hosted in early May of this year was to talk about all of these services that are available, to, of course, inject the United States' own funding as well to help prevent and, again, rehabilitate these child soldiers.
What about the need for the United States to intervene in some of these conflicts where children soldiers are being used, or to do more to bring about peace in these areas and in some of these terribly intractable conflicts that are going on? Isn't that also part of the overall approach that's needed?
Well, you make a very good point. You know, in Iraq, for example, we have heard from preliminary results that child soldiers have been found. But unfortunately, because of the current situation, we can't really go in and do a study or determine that with great specificity. So until the security situation in Iraq, for example, improves, we we're only getting secondhand reports.
And also, apart from giving money for these kinds of programs that you've outlined, what kind of pressure can be brought by the U.S. against governments that are forcing kids under the age of 18 to fight as soldiers?
I think this has to be a moral call to the international community of civilized nations. You know, there are over 300,000 young people who are forcibly coerced into armed conflict. And as I'm sure you've talked about already, I mean, these children are used as combatants, guards, spies, porters, you know, messengers, and girls are especially vulnerable because they're often used as sex slaves. I mean, this cannot continue. And child soldiers are used all over the world, and there has to be an effort to publicize the plight of these children, to publicize the extent of this program, and then call upon the international community of civilized nations to put a stop to this.
What about sanctions? Could sanctions be enforced?
I think as we talk more about the issue and the problems, we will talk about a whole host of ways to prevent and also rehabilitate child soldiers.
All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Elaine Chao is the Secretary of Labor. She spoke to us from her office here in Washington. If you'd like to join our discussion, the number is 1-800-989-8255. And Joe Becker, I wanted to ask you about this whole question of rehabilitating and reintegrating these children back into their families and society. The caller that we heard before who described pretty terrible atrocities being committed by very young children. He was saying 6 and 7 years old. I mean, how do they go back to what we would think of as a normal life?
It can be quite difficult, but it's not impossible. It's very important that these children receive assistance, that they have a chance to talk with counselors about their experience, that they have social workers that can work with them and their families. Sometimes families are initially reluctant to take children back, especially if they know their child has committed atrocities. And so in some communities in Africa, for example, they have rituals that are used in local communities to help the child sort of figuratively put their old life behind and rejoin the community in a new stage of life. Or, for example, to participate in reconstruction of schools or even to assist families of their victims as a way to sort of give back to society and pay for the awful things that they have done.
Are there programs existing that have found to be some more effective than others? I mean, what's the most effective approach to this?
One of the essential things is to work with local communities and use the local norms that exist. And if there are, you know, traditional rituals, for example, in a community, to use those. There's no one template for rehabilitation because countries do vary quite a bit from one to another. But some of the elements that Secretary Chao outlined, including, you know, education, vocational training, family reunification, these are essential elements of any program.
Is the United States, and for that matter, the international community, doing enough at this point on this issue, do you think?
I think the U.S. could do a lot more. The financial support for rehabilitation programs is very important, but, for example, next week the United States has a real opportunity. President Bush will be visiting several countries in Africa, which is the region that's been hardest hit by this problem. He needs to publicly speak out and call on governments and armed groups alike to end all recruitment of children and to begin the demobilization process. In a number of cases, he's just been silent on this issue when addressing the conflicts in Africa.
All right, let's take another call. We have Edward in East Troy, Wisconsin. Hi, Edward.
Hi, great topic. I'm very disturbed by this, but one question I have is sort of off of something you said earlier, Lynn, which is we now have entire generations in many countries that have young people who've been immersed in violence during what really is part of their later formative years. Even if the ILO, Department of Labor, and other agencies do succeed in creating, rebuilding infrastructure, doing job training, aren't we facing a near-term future of a whole generation that's just immersed in violence? So we do have truck drivers and carpenters and machine operators, but isn't there going to be a greater likelihood that they'll solve disputes like fenders in the streets with violence or take a reprimand from a supervisor and act out on it violently? I mean, aren't aren't we just looking at an entire generation that's going to be continuing as violence as part of their life, whether it's a meaningful economic situation or not?
All right. Thanks for that question, Edward. Joe Becker, what are the implications for societies after the war has ended?
It really depends on how the society responds to the child soldiers. A bad example is Liberia. In the previous conflict, before the recent upsurge, there were thousands of children that were demobilized very quickly but not given adequate assistance in really going back to school or getting job training for other jobs. And as a result, when conflict emerged again in West Africa, these same children were quickly re-recruited. But in other cases, children can find another life that they prefer to picking up the gun. If they have a chance to go back to school, if they have a chance to learn to be, you know, a seamstress, a carpenter, a computer technician, whatever it is, the cycle can be broken. I've gotten to know a young man who is now in the United States after being a child soldier for years in Sierra Leone. He's studying political science now at a college in Ohio and is completely committed to going back to his country and building it peacefully into a stronger nation.
So would you say education is the key to rehabilitation?
Education is absolutely the key, and helping children find other alternatives besides picking up the gun. They need to be able to make a productive life for themselves, earn some money without joining an armed group.
Also, one other thing, we've talked about the fact that this is a global problem. Do different cultures respond differently to the kids coming back into society? Is it different in Asia from Africa, from Latin America?
It does differ from country to country. It also differs from family to family. Like in Colombia, for example, we found that many children who joined armed groups were doing it because they weren't happy at home. They might have been, you know, fleeing situations of domestic violence or sexual abuse. And in those cases, actually, children don't want to go back to their families, and they probably shouldn't if it wasn't a healthy environment to begin with. So a lot of this needs to be looked at in terms of a, you know, case-by-case basis. There's no, you know, one solution for all situations.
Joe Becker is the Child Rights Advocacy Director for Human Rights Watch. We're talking about what's being done to stop the forced abduction and use of children as soldiers around the world. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. Tomorrow, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Inalienable rights engraved on walls across the country and on our national psyche. But what about that last one? The history of happiness as a political right. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Today, we're talking about the use of child soldiers around the world and how the international community is dealing with it. Our guests are Joe Becker, Child Rights Advocacy Director for Human Rights Watch. And joining us now is Olara Otunu, the UN Secretary General's Special Representative for Children and Armed Conflict. He's also a former Foreign Minister of Uganda. Thanks for being with us, Mr. Otunu.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Lynn.
Tell us what the UN and the international community can do and is doing right now to protect children from being forced into armed conflict.
Key members of the international community, meaning the United Nations, non-governmental organizations like Joe Becker's organization, local civil society groups, religious institutions, regional organizations, we've been working together to reverse this abominable trend of recruiting and using children as child soldiers. First, we've been ensuring that the world knows what we do to our children in situations of conflict, that there is a base of awareness within the public and in official circles. Secondly, we've been working together to make sure that there are clear and strong standards and rules with regard to the protection and ensuring the rights of children in situations of conflict. For example, in recent years, the Rome Statute creating the new International Criminal Court has specific provisions concerning the protection of children. Recruiting and using child soldiers is now a war crime. Grave sexual violence against girls is a war crime. Intentional attacking schools and hospitals is a war crime. There is something called the Optional Protocol, which is an amendment to the Convention on the Rights of the Child, which now raises the age limit for any person to participate in war from 15 to 18. The Security Council of the United Nations, which is, if you like, the international center, the hub of international peace and security, has now devoted a number of resolutions to this issue. And in fact, the Security Council, for the first time last year, requested a naming and shaming list of parties to conflict that continue to recruit and use children as child soldiers.
Then,
of course,
you,
at the regional level, regional organization from the European Parliament to the Economic Commission for Africa, as well as international and local NGOs, have all been very deeply engaged in advocacy as well as in developing programs on the ground.
Let me ask you how these international treaties and conventions, how are they being enforced? What pressure is being put on these countries? Are there any penalties involved if they break these conventions?
Well, I'll say maybe a couple of things. First, the most important thing right now is the court of international public opinion. Because we live in a world which has become so inextricably linked, the silver lining in the globalization of our world is the fact that nobody is indifferent to how they are perceived internationally. And this is true of all the groups involved in fighting. So we must bring the full force of international public opinion to lean on those who are brutalizing children in this way. Secondly, we must work to develop a more systematic network for monitoring and reporting on what those who are involved in fighting are doing to children. Jo Baker and her group are already involved in this in an important way. The Security Council is now involved in this. We are trying to get other actors to be part of this so that we know verse and chapter what is being done in Colombia, Sri Lanka, Congo, Liberia to children by whom. And then we use that base of knowledge to trigger pressure, diplomatic, political pressure on the parties in conflict. And thirdly, I'd say it's very important that we should work to develop, to strengthen, to support civil society and NGO networks at the national and at regional levels in the Great Lakes of Africa and the Balkans, in Western Africa. For example, in Southeast Asia, so they are the witnesses on the ground, and the information they get can then be used internationally, but they can also use the international standards that I referred to earlier as tools for advocacy and protection on the ground. It is what, in one word, we've called embarking on the era of application. We've spent decades developing the new standards and strengthening them. That was the era of the development, the elaboration of standards. Now we must embark on the era of the application of those standards on the ground where it can make a difference in the lives of children who are exposed to war and danger.
Well, thank you very much for speaking with us today. Olara Otunnu is the UN Secretary General's Special Representative for Children and Armed Conflict. He spoke to us from his office in New York. And let's see if we can get one more call in here. Jules in Burlington, Vermont.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to comment on the situation of orphanages in war zones. 3 years ago, I worked in the Northern Conflict Zone in Sri Lanka. And when I was working there, one of the things that we were able to observe but not document was children who were living in orphanages that were run by the military. And there were times when we were driving down the road doing, you know, humanitarian aid work where we would basically see what looked like military daycare. Children, you know, as young as four, who the military, the paramilitary, was the only sort of family or any kind of structure within their life. And I was just wondering if you all could comment on that.
Jo Becker?
I'm not familiar with what you're describing in Sri Lanka specifically, but certainly there are other cases. In Burma, for example, the military has run schools that are held within military bases where children as young as 4 or 5 are given both education and military training and expected to join the army when they get a little bit older. So there are a lot of ways that armies and armed groups do try and cultivate children as soldiers from very, very young ages.
All right. Thanks so much for your call, Jules. You know, Joe, I can't help thinking that people listening here in this country hear these terrible stories and, horrifying atrocities. But probably are at a loss thinking, what in the world can I do about this? I wonder if you have any ideas about how an individual who is concerned about this can respond in any way.
Well, I think individuals need to be in touch with their governments and encourage their governments to use all forms of pressure against the forces that are recruiting and using children. This includes not only speaking out publicly condemning child recruitment, but also, denying any military aid, for example, to any group that has children in its forces, or limiting visas to leaders from groups that are using children, looking at other forms of sanctions, freezing assets of the leaders that are responsible. I think for us to end this phenomenon, every government, and especially the most influential ones, the United States, European states, need to be actively engaged in speaking out and using the forms of leverage that they have available.
Do you think the international community is as actively engaged and as strong on this issue as it should be at this point?
Well, it can always do more, but there are some positive signs. There are more than 50 governments that in the last 3 years have ratified the new UN treaty that prohibits the use of children under 15 in armed conflict. There have been large-scale demobilizations of children in Sierra Leone, in Sudan. The government of Colombia changed its legislation and demobilized 15,000 children from its army. There are other groups that have made commitments not to use children. So we are seeing some progress, but clearly there's a lot more that needs to be done.
Well, thanks very much for being with us today, Joe.
You're welcome.
Joe Becker is the Child Rights Advocacy Director for Human Rights Watch. She was with us from our bureau in New York. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.